total of three. So waiting on Ted and Katie, we decided to proceed with the agenda. So our first up is review of minutes.
Move approval.
All in favor?
Aye.
All in favor? Okay. Thank you. So we have the March 9th minutes. Moved by John, second by Greg.
Committee activities since the March OIC meeting includes a $60 million commitment to Mayfield 15 and Mayfield Select Fund. That was in the Private Equity Committee on April 13th. And then in the Real Estate Committee on April 11th, a $250 million commitment to Divco West Real Estate Fund 5 was approved. And then I also want to report two additional commitments. They're really under the header of rebalancing. $50 million in the alternatives portfolio to Sailing Stone Capital Partners Global Natural Resources Strategy, and $25 million to Sailing Stone Capital Partners Natural Gas Strategy in the Opportunity Portfolio. Both of those additional commitments were approved via staff discretion.
Good morning. It's my privilege to introduce the first investment recommendation on the agenda this morning. It is for Seven Bridge Special Credit Partners 3 and Seven Bridge Special Credit Partners 3 Flex. In a moment, I'll bring up the general partner who we've had a relationship with since the firm was founded about a decade ago. But I thought I'd make a couple of introductory comments because this is a slightly different profile from a lot of the buyout or venture capital funds that make up the majority of our private equity program. We're going to be discussing Centerbridge's non-controlled stress debt strategy this morning. It's a niche portion of the special situation segment of the private equity program from an allocation perspective, and it plays a potentially interesting role at different points in the cycle from a portfolio construction perspective. It has a somewhat lower risk profile than the buyout and venture funds that probably enjoy the portfolio, but it also has a potentially interesting diversifying counter-cyclical element to the return profile. It is a strategy that involves acquisition of loans and high-yield bonds of companies undergoing some form of stress that managers in this space will create value through deep and detailed underwriting the security selection process, as well as through navigating effectively restructuring processes that unlock value for creditors. It's very much a specialist game. There's very few managers in the world with a long-term track record across multiple cycles of effectively operating in the strategy, and we're fortunate to have one such manager with us this morning. Jeff Aronson is the lead portfolio manager on Centerbridge's non-controlled distress strategy. He was formerly the head of stress debt, Angelo Gordon, before founding Centerbridge with his co-founder 10 years ago. So with that, I will just one other comment. Centerbridge is targeting $5 billion with a maximum of $6 billion across these two funds, which is to set the scale of what we're discussing. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jeff.
Good morning. Thanks, Mike. Pleasure to be here today. What I thought I would do for starters, I believe you have a copy of our presentation materials. Even though I've been here before a number of times, we'll start with a brief overview of the firm and our history, and tell you a little bit about how we're organized as a firm. Talk a little bit about what we've been doing lately in this strategy, and save the bulk of my comments for what we think is the opportunity set going forward, and hope to be interactive. So by way of background, as Mike mentioned, we are now in our 11th year of our operation. Prior to co-founding Centerbridge with my partner, Mark Lovely, I was at a firm called Angelo Gordon & Company for many years, dating back to the late 1980s, so I've been in the distress security industry for quite some time. I met my partner about 15 years ago when I was still at my old firm, and Mark ran the private equity group at Blackstone. This was probably around the year 2000 or 2001, where Blackstone had not historically been active in the credit world, and that it focused mostly on traditional private equity. Mark and I were introduced by a mutual friend. Mark and his team were very interested in our strategy, but they were quite self-aware. They knew they didn't know. And they reached out to us to partner on some investments, 50-50, on a very quiet handshake. And the idea, and again, this was quite some time ago, is that we would each bring our respective skill sets to the fore. And the way that I describe it now, if you think about a company's balance sheet, you've got assets on the left side and liabilities on the other. And Mark and his team were really good at the left-hand side of the balance sheet. And we were good on the right-hand side of the balance sheet. And we also had a good understanding of markets, something which most private equity investors have less familiarity with. And so we partnered at our old firms, and we made a number of successful co-investments together. And we became good friends in the process, and we eventually decided to leave and form our own firm based upon this notion of partnership. And we both left our firms in 2005. The name of our firm, Centerbridge, came from the fact that we were taking two strategies, equity and debt, and bridging them to the center. And so we kicked off our firm in October of 2005, and it was me, Mark, and we had an assistant. Today, we have just under 260 employees, of whom around 83 are investment professionals. We have an office in New York City. We also have one other office in London, where we have a European effort.
Jeff, if I may, what was the initial capital? If you came off a cliff, you certainly had to have the means to do that.
Well, the initial capital, Mark and I funded the losses out of our pocket. We went out to raise our first fund. We have two strategies, as Mike alluded to. One is control strategy. Think of that as traditional private equity. And the other is non-control, which is more focused on distress. Our first fund, and again, this was the end of 05, beginning of 06, was the control strategy. And I'll explain why in a moment. And we went out to raise that first fund in the beginning of 06. And our first fund was $3.2 billion. So it was a very successful inaugural launch, of which Oregon was a large participant in that fund. We did not raise a non-control fund at that time. Why not? Because the timing wasn't right. And our non-control strategy is highly cyclical, as I'm going to discuss, and we think there are times to emphasize it. And conversely, we think there are times to de-emphasize it. So unlike in a traditional private equity strategy where general partners are periodically raising capital, that is not the case with our non-control strategy. And I'll touch on that in a moment. So again, we built up the firm. I guess we're no longer a new firm, but we're still a young firm, and we're now in our 11th year of operation. To date, we have raised three control funds, Centerbridge Capital Partners 1, 2, and 3, of which the state is an LP in all of them. And we have done two non-control funds, Centerbridge Special Credit Partners 1 and Special Credit Partners 2. And if you turn to page 13, why don't I first start with Special Credit 1. Again, this is a non-control strategy. We're not looking to own businesses in this strategy. That is not what we're looking to do. We are, however, looking to be a principal, an active participant to help create value in all of these deals. And let me give you an example that I mean by that. In all restructurings, in all distressed situations, if you think about it broadly, By definition, there's never enough value to satisfy everyone. Obviously, if there were, it wouldn't be a restructuring. So what that means in each one of these transactions, there's generally winners and losers, because the pie is only so big, there's not a, there's insufficient value. And it's a zero-sum game. What we look to do in each of our investments is to target a particular class of debt and purchase enough of that debt so that we can be at the negotiating table to determine, keeping with my pie metaphor, how the pie will be sliced to make sure that we get, you know, the largest piece possible. So it is not a passive strategy. We just don't buy a loan or a bond and hope that the price will rise in the market. We want to be a principal at each of these tables. So in that regard, it's identical to traditional private equity in that we're trying to manufacture value. We're trying to create it. The way we have built the firm, and then I'll touch on Special Credit One, is that we did not want to have a series of different teams focused on different funds. We did not want a private equity team focused on a private equity fund, and a distress team focused on a distress fund, and so on and so forth. Even though that's the traditional model, is to have a silo-based structure, we thought we wanted to have one team, one group of investors that could invest up and down the capital structure, from equity to debt. And we thought that made a lot of sense. And the idea was, let's build a team of switch hitters. Because the skills between private equity and distress, if they're not identical, but they're quite complementary. And as Mike mentioned, the strategies are counter-cyclical. When private equity is booming, distress is quiet, and vice versa. And we like that element of counter-cyclicality. As a result, to back up to your question, when we started the firm in 05 and 06, we did not raise a non-controlled distress fund for the simple reason there wasn't a lot to do. It is a highly cyclical strategy, and as a firm, we're very deep believers in cycles. We only decided to raise our first non-controlled fund in 2009. So we waited a number of years, and that first fund was Special Credit One, which is on page 13, where we raised that bond in the second half of 2009. It's been a very successful bond. We've been really pleased with it, and we've been in harvest mode. Mike mentioned, and I just wanted to reiterate, the risk-return profile of this type of strategy differs from private equity for one very obvious reason. We're not buying equity. We're typically investing in debt, which ranks higher in the capital structure than equity, and we're generally focused on senior debt as opposed to subordinated debt. So really high up in the capital stack, where we believe fundamentally there's less risk than buying equity, for example, in a traditional leverage buyout where all that debt is stacked on top of it.
Jeff, why don't you raise the special credit fund too. So this type one.
So if you turn to page 16, we raised that fund in 2012. We raised that fund less so because of what was happening in the United States. We knew that the distress cycle was starting to wane in 2012. And more so because we thought that there was a reasonable likelihood of a repeat of that cycle in Europe. This was a time around the time that the euro crisis was really starting to bloom. And we thought that the European banks would act similarly to the US banks and clean house. And I would say that happened to a certain extent, but not nearly to the same extent as US financial institutions. And you look at what's happening in Europe, and perhaps they're still dealing with the consequences of not addressing it as fast as their U.S. counterparts did. So we raised that fund in 2012. It was also a $2 billion fund, the same as Special Credit One. The ramp-up went quite well. We were performing quite nicely for the first few years of the ramp-up. Last year, we ended up giving back most of the profits that we had generated on a mark-to-market basis, not realized. Why is that? We think principally because when you look at what's happened in the distressed market over the past 12 to 15 months, we've been in a very sharp bear market. The U.S. distressed index last year was down around 38%. It was the second worst performance since they started tracking the data back in the 90s. The worst year, not surprisingly, was 2008. I've been through bear markets before. I've been doing this for a while. When that happens, we mark down the portfolio. It doesn't make me crazy because I think the likelihood that we made a mistake in everything we've done is just not the case. Bear markets, we mark it down. And as a result, the timeline to achieve the underwritten returns is always extended, but it kind of comes with the strategy.
So, yeah. The interesting term, distressed debt, an index of that. A bear market in distress is a positive for the stock market, I would assume.
I don't know if it's necessarily a positive for the stock market. We have a chart in here, which is a really interesting piece of data. It turns out to be an excellent leading indicator as to the default rate. And I will walk you through. We have a page on that. That when the distressed market declines, the distressed index is compiled by Bank of America Merrill Lynch. We've been tracking it for a few decades. It turns out to be a great leading indicator of what's likely to happen in the default rate. And I can show you that data.
So a uptick in the default rate is a bull market for the distressed index?
Ultimately, it will be.
Okay.
Ultimately, it will be. Once people come out and realize that the world is not ending. And you think about, this is a highly contrarian strategy. We invest in things that generally no one else wants. At a point of maximum uncertainty and fear. So when there's a fire, we're running into it, whereas most people are running away from it. What happens when people run away? They sell. What happens to prices generally? They decline, and that's what we want to try to capitalize on.
You're such an interesting person to interact with. I'm going to pull you off the printed page. So in addition to looking at that chart that you think is interesting, I'd love to know what other factors you look at in determining the timing for raising new funds and why you think it's a bull market. And then after that, whether you think that central bank intervention is going to blow out your duration, so to speak.
Let's turn right to that. So I would go to page 21 and answer both of your questions in terms of the things that we look for. And then our view on banking policy and how that's going to impact things. So this page here, we showed you 11 years ago when we first came here. This hasn't changed. We are big, big believers in investment cycles. So we're always asking ourselves, where are we in the cycle today? And it's never precise, but it's usually a function of looking at data and also looking at our experience. The next page shows the high yield default rate since really the start of modern leverage finance. I'm on page 22. And this goes back about 35 years. And as you can see here, there's a really interesting pattern. Every 7 or 8 years or so, the credit cycle tends to turn. I don't know why it's 7 or 8 years, as opposed to 3 years or 15 years. I joked once, perhaps it's the average length of a career of a person in finance. By the time 7 years has elapsed, all the people who were there before are gone, and there's a new crop of people. Because I think one of my favorite things about working in finance is people tend to forget what you did yesterday. It's actually quite remarkable.
Average marriage duration too, I think.
And it's probably also there. So you have this 7 to 8 year pattern. So we like to look at what does the data tell us in terms of where we are in the cycle. When you think where we are today, we still talk about the financial crisis as if it were a couple months ago. I don't know about all of you. But when you step back, it was 8 years ago. And I don't think people really think about it. It was a long time ago, and a lot has transpired in the meantime. So we wanted to explore that further. So just flipping pages, we tend to pay very close attention to what's happening in the private equity world, not only because we're intimately involved in that world, but it's also a good leading indicator as to what may happen to default. You know a lot of this information. Private equity activity, as you can see on page 23, tends to come in waves. And if you look at the next page, purchase prices, expressed as multiples, tend to peak when private equity activity is stronger. So if you kind of line these two pages up against each other, you can see that. And so we put a question mark over on the right-hand side. This is truly a peak. What's happening in the credit world? Page 25 shows new issue quality. And this is prepared by Standard & Poor's. And what you can see here, and we actually found it surprising, is that new issue quality recently is worse than it was at the peak of the last cycle in 06 and 07. And we thought that was unusual. We called Standard & Poor's and asked, did they change their ratings methodology? Did they make it more stringent? And the answer, interestingly, was yes and no. They changed their methodology with respect to asset-backed securities, but not with respect to corporate, which is what we're focused on. So this truly is an apples-to-apples comparison. So you can see where the issue quality is today. What's happening in the broader high-yield market? If you look at page 26. This is not an index. This is every high-yield issuer whose data is aggregated, every single issuer, all of the debt is added up. And then we look at net leverage, which is gross debt minus cash, divided by EBITDA for the entire universe. And there's roughly $1.3 trillion of high-yield bond outstanding today. The higher the leverage ratio, the more imperiled the business. And what's interesting about this chart is if you look at the last two peaks, each of which coincided with a strong time to invest in distressed securities, in 2001 and 2009, the last two cycles, we were in the midst of recession. There was a recession in 2001, there was a recession in 2009. Today, we're nowhere near recession. And you can kind of see where the math is today. The next page.
This is scary.
Yeah. Well, I'm in a good mood.
So, but just looking at the magnitude of the difference between 2009 and 2015, this is sort of dovetails into my central bank meddling question, which is maybe we are in a recession, and it's being shown by the leverage ratio and other indicators, and not by GDP or equity performance.
I hadn't thought about that. That could be. Some of this is clearly due to turmoil in the energy world, because energy represents around 17% of the high yield universe. But even if you take that out, I mean, the numbers are pretty startling.
So then, having seen the refinance wave that's coming from some large issuers that are highly competitive businesses, it seems to me things like telecom and wireless telecom, that this number could be pretty large. I guess that's why you're here today.
As I said,
All right.
If you flip the page, this is pretty much the inverse. This shows interest coverage ratio. This is operating profit, EBITDA divided by interest. The lower the ratio, the tougher shape the business is in. And again, if you look at the last two troughs, which was a great time for distressed securities investing, 2001-09, we were in the midst of recession, and today we're not. This may beg your question.
Do you know how much the high yield index has changed between 15 and 9? So was energy 17% at that time, or was there some other driver of the uptake at that time? I actually don't know.
Well, what's interesting, if you look at, if you flip forward a couple pages, you kind of dig into it. If you go to page 32, historical relationships, what we have observed over many cycles is that the most speculative part of the credit market tends to unwind first when you're at one of these turning points in the credit cycle. So if you look back to the late 90s, what unraveled first? The largest sector of the high yield market. Back then it was telecom. If you look to the mid-2000s, what unraveled first? Subprime lending. And if you look to the current cycle, what unraveled last year? Energy. In each of those instances, that was typically the most speculative part of the credit market. And again, historically, what happens when we look at the data, that usually tends to become unglued first, and then it spreads to other areas of the credit world. I can just flip back to page 28. Because everything I've said before, we've seen this show before. You tend to see the same patterns over and over again. You can see that in the data. In finance, people often say, you know, it's different this time, and the response to that is never different. Pages 28, 29, and 30, this is different. So for decades, our largest competitor, one of our largest competitors, has not been other funds, and there have been a handful of us who have been doing this for a long time. But it's generally been banks, Wall Street, for their own account. And that's no longer because of what's happening in the regulatory environment. And you can see this on page 28. This shows holdings of credit by banks. And you can see at the top of the last cycle, 07-08, it was around $350 billion. And more recently, it's about $50 billion. So they're no longer in that business. In thinking about it, I probably presented it incorrectly. What I should have done is to compare the holdings back in 08 to the size of the market, the credit market. The credit market today is much larger than it was 7 or 8 years ago. So as a fraction, this $50 billion is spread over a much larger denominator because the credit market is that much larger. But it makes the same point, is that there's really been a retreat from Wall Street in this area. That's good for us because one of our biggest competitors is gone. There's been a lot of press about this lately. If you flip the pages, liquidity and the credit market is down substantially because of this retreat by Wall Street. That's a great thing for us.
So who, in thinking of sort of natural issue here, you'll have other competitors, right? You step in, insurance companies?
No, there are a handful of firms that will focus on distressed securities. If it's not a bank, it's not an insurance company. And there have been a lot of people come and go in this business, and there's a small group of us who've been doing this and competing with each other since the late 1980s. But having taken out the biggest buyer of debt, which is Wall Street, I think that's great because a huge source of demand has been eliminated, but there's still this tremendous amount of supply. The next page is also about
The banks were holding these bonds for income or for capital appreciation?
It's a good question. I don't know because I have never worked at a bank. My guess is both. But it's a good question. But from a regulatory standpoint, proprietary trading desks have been eliminated. And even market making activities have become more expensive because there are higher capital charges to hold these types of instruments for a bank these days. So that's why their balance sheet have really contracted. And I think that bodes well to us.
Okay.
The next page, in terms of the lack of liquidity, page 3, there's been a lot of press about this, including there's an article, there's an op-ed in today's Wall Street Journal by the Treasury Secretary, Jack Lew, who talks about this very point, which is illustrated here. The potential concerns in the asset management industry about having vehicles such as mutual funds and ETFs, which are highly liquid vehicles, but the underlying instruments, high-yield bonds, for example, they trade like cement. So you really have this, duration mismatch, and I think it's something that regulators are paying close attention to, which again bodes well to us because we offer liquidity in those instances when there are too many sellers and not enough buyers. I want to have more time for questions, so I'll finish up. Page 31 is my favorite page in the entire presentation. Yeah, it's fascinating. I like to quote Mark Twain or what he purportedly said, that history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. And page 31, it's almost to the point where we can cut and paste the data, because what you see here, the blue bars are private equity activity. There's typically a burst of private equity activity. There are mistakes made. What happens? Defaults rise, private equity activity subsides. Defaults peak, they start to decline. What happens to private equity activity? You can just chart it right here with your finger. It rises again. And then people make the same mistakes again. People get sloppy, private equity activity subsides, defaults spike, and that cycle just keeps going. So we put on the far right-hand side of that page a question mark in terms of what we think is going to happen to defaults. I touched on page 32. A lot of what we see in private equity and in the credit world is driven by this 7-year cycle that I touched on earlier on page 33. It's typically 7 years of growth in the leveraged finance world, and then there's a default spike. Page 34, technicals. We touched on this earlier. This is a very busy chart. The blue line is the distress index. The red line is the default rate. And as you can see here, the blue line historically has been an excellent leading indicator of what the default rate is going to do. So the blue line declines.
You know, you're no fun at all.
No.
You're smart. I wouldn't want to do this. So the harsh thing about this for Gen Xers, each of these points are points when we were graduating from graduate school or college.
You see, I don't even know what Gen X means.
Wow, this is horrible. So basically for the rest of our lives.
Because things go in cycles.
Yeah.
You know, it's never things don't go to the moon and things, you know, don't go down to
the most.
Yeah. Maybe you should chart generations first year against your cycles.
We'll plot that next time. When I'm back here 2 years from now, I'll try that.
Yeah.
So to conclude, defaults, I'm on page 35 now, are starting to move up. The default rate now is around 4%. What we did is we tried to calculate what would the default rate be if companies whose debt traded below 50 cents in the dollar, i.e. deeply, deeply distressed, debt is trading below 50 cents in the dollar, the market signaling that this company is likely to default. If all of those companies defaulted, the default rate would more than double to around 10% today. So I want to come back to your question on central bank policy, but to conclude, we know we can't predict the future, but we have a deep belief in cycles, and we look at the data, we look to our experience, we think the credit cycle is approaching one of those inflection points of every 7 years or so. Yeah, you know, central bank policy, I mean, we're not economists. You know, we're very much micro into the weeds on each transaction. That is not my personal view. I think we all suffer from a bit of, remember the old Bill Murray movie, Groundhog Day? I think we're all numb to it. I think every day, you know, you read the paper on negative interest rates, okay, and, you know, let me check the sports scores. And I don't think, and I fall prey to this all the time, that we don't step back and say, wow, what does that mean, that interest rates are negative? What is it? Who would have ever predicted this 5 years ago or 10 years ago? But now we just kind of take it for granted. It's like, okay, let me go check the sports scores next. Because it's constantly repeated, and I don't think we step back. I think, you know, I'm not the first person to say this, we're in the midst of a huge experiment. A huge experiment. It's never been done before. And how it's going to turn out, you know, I don't know, but, you know, cycles haven't been rendered obsolete by the internet. As we look at it, we think we're at one of those points. But again, I know we don't know. So we've structured this fund with that reality in mind. So we think if we're correct about the cycle turning, and we strongly believe that, it will be smart for us to have a big war chest because we think the opportunities will be profound. Not only because of the size of the potential market, but because our biggest competitor, the banks, for their own account, they've been eliminated. So that's a great thing. But we can't say for sure. So what we've done is we've structured the fund with what we call a main fund, which will be, we'll call it $1.25 billion. So a lot of money, but not an enormous sum of capital that we would be investing currently because there are opportunities out there now. But the bulk of the fund would be in what we call a flex fund. So the way to think about it, simplistically, if an investor commits $1, we'll look to invest 25 cents of that now, with the 75 cents basically in reserve, so that if we're right about the cycle turning, we can activate that flex fund, flip the switch, which will give us a large war chest. From an investor standpoint, you know, that's not free. I mean, we don't charge fees on that bulk of the capital, the 75 cents. So commitment fees is no nothing. But there is an opportunity cost because investors are committing. But a number of our investors have really, you know, they like the structure a lot because while they also think the cycle is turning, they also know they can't know. And they like the optionality associated with that flex fund, that if our forecast is correct, that people will be able to invest a lot of capital and I think highly profitable rates of return.
I'm impressed that you were able to raise your first fund, particularly given that magnitude. You didn't have a reputation of the firm itself, but it's brand new, but it must be a reputation of the two of you.
Mark and I have both been investing in, broadly speaking, the alternative space, private equity and distress since the 1980s. When we left our firms, Mark left Blackstone, I left Angelo Gordon, both firms could not have been more gracious, and they gave us our track records. And we also had relationships with a number of institutional investors, and you know, we were really fortunate.
Any other questions?
Somewhat off topic. I do have a question. With all the information you've shown us about the current environment, what about shorting?
I'm not very good at it. You know, I try it once a year. I lose money. Say I'll do it again. I'll do it next year. Shorting is much more of a trading-oriented quarter-to-quarter, and that's really not how we are built as investors. These are all longer-term investments. We certainly pay attention to markets, but not with a trigger finger. And more importantly, shorting is passive. you short something and you kind of sit back and wait for the market to recognize what you think is correct. We want to be, again, as a principal in all of these deals, we want to be at the table. You can't do that short.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, just to summarize and offer up the specific recommendation, I think it's the view of staff. I'm sorry. Just Tom Marks from Troy Cove joining me, my partner in private equity team. Staff's view that this is one of very, very few top tier managers operating in this non-controlled stress strategy. It really is truly a niche specialist business. I think, Jeff, I think the question about the success of raising that first fund is on point. I think it's probably undersold. This was a big event for these two individuals with sterling reputations for this firm. And at that time, that was the most successful first-time fund ever raised, which sort of speaks for the pedigree of individuals. Specifically, it's a big opportunity before us today. We think it's an interesting point in the cycle, as Jeff outlined, to introduce this exposure to the private equity program. However, this is unique because we don't generally make tactical investment decisions in the private equity program, primarily because, A, none of us has a crystal ball. But B, we invest in fund structures, which are just notoriously poor tactical investment vehicles. They have very long lives, very long investment periods. In distress, this concept of a main fund, flex fund, A fund, B fund is a newer thing, but it's been around for about a decade. Oaktree sort of pioneered it. And it's incredibly effective when done properly at managing cyclicality. Specific recommendation here is that we would allocate $500 million overall. 25% or $125 million would be the main fund, 75% or $375 million the flex fund. We are certainly putting the discretion in the hands of Jeff and his team, but our thesis is if a cycle does not present itself over the next couple of years, our exposure is limited to the 25% in the main fund, $125 million. If the cycle presents itself, we've got much more exposure at a very interesting point in the cycle. So we're happy to answer any questions. Happy to talk about distress, how it fits in the portfolio. I know that's, again, this is a unique thing. It's not a buyout fund, which is what we normally present at this point. So with that, I'll ask for questions, please.
Just real quickly, are there other managers you might bring within this space?
So in special situations, we have sort of a 7.5 allocation to.
Yeah.
It's a small allocation. In distressed overall, we have a small group of managers. In the non-controlled stress, which is this strategy, the lower risk spectrum part of it, we have Oaktree, our opportunities funds. They just raised last year, I think, these are the two best managers, in my personal view, in the market. So we're not going to go out hunting for another one. We thought it made sense to make one big bet in addition to what we have with Oaktree. We have a pretty good dialogue with both managers. So if it becomes very interesting, we're going to want to be a first call basis with these two. But frankly, there's just not that many good managers doing this. We've done it for a long period of time.
I thought somewhere in the 200 pages there was a list of our co-investors. Are those deals that are largely done? Are we late or early in the stage of the
previous investors?
The current, the other investors, yeah, in these funds.
We'll participate in the first close of, should it be approved, we would be a first closer. So we're at the front end of the fund through process, for sure. And again, we have a relationship with the GP that's a decade old. So on the advisory board, et cetera.
But the expectation is that they will be able to raise the balance?
Yes.
Why was
you
wrong about timing the call, right? And I really like how they structured this for us, and that we're not charged for even the entire commitment. What's the duration of the option on the flex? The investment period?
It's the investment period of the main fund. It's 3 years. So that's the activation window for the plus fund.
I can empathize with it because in the office building business, if a big refinancing is coming, I drive my family nuts. If I go out on the front porch, read the newspaper and say, yes, the economy's been tanked. Keep the 10-year treasury down.
Okay, do we have a motion to approve staff recommendation?
So moved. Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you very much.
Can you just clarify which was the mover, who was the second?
Rakai
was the mover. Okay, great.
Rakai was the
So included in that is the first strategic relationship with A2R, that was a diversifying strategy. First joint venture with Twin Creeks in the timber space. Our first land-based ag investment with Brookfield. And our first private open-ended investment with Hayes River in the ag space. So it's statutory code and spending a lot of time researching these different strategies and structures, and it's like a right to see such recommendations. So moving charging ahead, pages 7 and 8 and portfolio initiatives. These are pretty self-explanatory, but I just wanted to provide a flavor of where we plan to spend some of our time for the remainder of 2016. And really immediately following this, we'll begin work on the first two, on the co-investment and separate accounts strategic relationships. And the vision here is really for this year, just to be, and I worded this intentionally, to commence project to determine the best approach for consideration of a co-investment program. So we're still in the early days of that evaluation. I also highlighted two other projects, diversifying strategies and infrastructure debt analysis. And this is our MO is when we assess a new asset class or strategy, we conduct what we call a sector review, or John refers to as a landscaping project, where we assess the manager universe, sort of the investment thesis, manager universe, talk about fees, and ultimately craft a plan. So we're in the implementation stage with diversifying strategies and still in the outline stage with the structure debt. Also noteworthy, because I think it demonstrates how we work across teams, so even though all portfolio teams use this two people, it's a much wider resource base. So jumping to pages 11 and 12, in the portfolio activity, and I would say this is really exactly what you expect for a program of our age, with cash outflows meaningfully outweighing cash inflow, and that's just a function of looking at building application. So you'd expect to see this relationship hold. And there, page 12 has some more data supporting that notion. And what I highlight is, number one, the program is very young. As we continue to make commitments, the average weighted age of the portfolio's commitments is approximately 2 years. And I would expect that persists for several years.
Could you, as you continue the presentation, could you talk a little bit about capacity and your essential rate of building the fund to get us somewhere near our target allocation?
Sure.
Obviously, a very small team. This is new. It's complex. You're trying to put the foundation of the program. But can you give us a sense of where you are and the time frame to get us into the allocation program?
Right. I think every year we get asked that question, and every year I say about 10 years. So I think we've made progress towards that. So within the 5 to 7 year range, we continue with the current basic commitment targeted I would expect that. But portfolio consists of 40% allocation to diversifying strategy. These are liquid. They draw down immediately, so you're able to finish that allocation quicker than the 50%, which would be your private market strategy, the infrastructure and natural resources. And these are drawdown type vehicles, so they'll take a lot of the scale.
But now that you've lived with this for a while, do you believe you have the capacity to be able to get us into the target range?
I do. And we have, I think, as a result, consistent with the OIC beliefs and resources, we've been very intentional about how we've built the portfolio. We've always targeted a relationship with budget, so we don't stretch our resources too greatly. So the ability, and you always hear me refer to certain anchor relationships, and those are the relationships that we can scale over time. So we may start with a small Fund 1 allocation. Stone Peak's a great example. It's a $100 million Fund 1 investment. Fund 2 has been meaningfully larger, a $400 million commitment. So that's sort of the model that we'll look to follow.
Okay. My concern, obviously, and I think I've expressed this in prior years,
We're not getting people to get to the goals of the investment belief if it's not scaled to the degree that it moves the dial.
Sure.
And that's my concern. We're still in what I would describe as wasting stage.
Right. Now, I think I sort of tortured the metaphor, but I've described the third inning of development. So that's really, I think the first inning is creating the framework, these are the targets, toes in water, as Sean described some of the strategies. Second inning, really refine those strategies and relationships you want to build. And the third inning, really exactly what I've described as the inning to the outside. So I'm not going to show the ninth inning yet, but working towards that. And to your point about resources, we are obviously, Torrey Hill has been a partner since day one of this portfolio, and I think serves an invaluable role. So I think on paper the resources are modest, but there definitely is more.
And I'm sorry to keep asking, just one more question, and I promise I'll stop. Do we have a sense, given the current size of the portfolio, is it actually doing anything with regard to the investment beliefs? In other words, if I could use my analogy, is our rudder even in the water yet?
Right. My view is yes. And I think we've seen where we have, especially in diversifying strategies, which is to date one large relationship with AQR. That made it perform exactly in line with expectations, so it provided us a diversification benefit. Returns have been, I think, above expectations. So it is, you're right, it's still a small allocation, but I think it's performed as intended.
Okay. We didn't want to support you and help you.
Right. In any way. And I share those, we share those concerns. I think I've been very mindful of our constraints and I'm not incentivized to take on more than I can.
Yeah, no, you'd be great. Thanks.
As a follow-on to that, on page 11, the dotted line shows fair market value. Mike, I gather that these are difficult things to value with any precision. If these values are accurate, then you're doing it well. But what's the level of precision? And the second question for you, Tom, is, do you know where we are with respect to our peers? You know, are other funds like ours doing roughly the same thing? Maybe two separate questions.
Yeah, on the valuation question, you know, there's a very diverse underlying set of assets in this portfolio, and so there's a lot of different methodologies that get applied for valuation. I would say they are reasonable approximations for point in time valuation, and you know there's a lot of discount cash flow analysis that goes into that with forward looking projection to drive those models. But I think those are fairly standard methodologies that get applied, and I think we're comfortable with the standards that are being used. And we've got a fairly robust peer group of like investments to compare this portfolio to see, you know, anomalies or things that might look out of whack, and I don't think we see any of that today. So I'd say it's a reasonable approximation of value. In terms of peer groups, I would say that this program, I would put a little bit on the cutting edge of what's going on in the broader market today. The legacy profile of the system with its history in private equity has created, you know, a real benefit for this program since its inception as a kind of quarter first call for people looking to raise capital. You know, that's brought a lot of garbage to the table, but it's also brought a lot of really innovative, cutting edge things to the table, like the joint venture we were involved with last year in the timber space. And so I would say, you know, you're ahead of the peer group in some ways from a sophistication perspective. There are others that are doing things with much larger teams. They're doing direct investments as their primary way of deploying capital. There are constraints here that don't allow that to happen. But I would say within that framework, you know, it's a pretty sophisticated approach to the market, and I think it's working well.
Just another step follow on Tom's comments. Real assets are becoming increasingly relevant to pension plans, but in spite of that, there's very little consistency in how investors define real assets, their objectives, perceived risks and benefits. So infrastructure, for example, some land has dedicated applications, some land that falls under real estate umbrella, some land that falls under property assets umbrella, some of it's private equity, so it's a moving target in terms of the peer comparison. So I guess final two slides. Slide 15 just highlights high-level expectations regarding pacing, so I can take away here consistent with the prior 2 years, starting 1.5 to 2 million in commitments. And the last slide I'm going to address is slide 16.
I'm sorry, where would the 6.7 to 7.2 get us a percentage of allocation target?
So the target would be, that's committed. If you take current OPERF NAV, like I said, this is out of March 31st. The target for this portfolio is 8.5 billion, approximately, 12.5%. Obviously, committed is not the same as invested, so it'll take longer to actually build that in, but
trying to have a control. Good, thank you.
So the page 16 is my kind of summarize, and it is a summary of the investment process. This was important for me to include just because I always, every recommendation I conclude with a statement, added it to the portfolio, and there's confidence the manager will achieve their objectives. And I wanted to show that it's more than just lip service, but there is a lot supporting the summary. In effect, these become rules for a new investment. So I think with every annual review, I'll try to incorporate some process-wise, just to eliminate what it is you do on a day-to-day basis. So ultimately, this concludes with a memo, which is a 2-3 page summary of the range. But just trying to, again, demonstrate that there is a lot that goes into that. So that's really all I had prepared to say. So happy to answer any questions or just email.
I have a question more to the point. If you look at page 14 of your deck, for the committee, I think it provides a really good framework for how you're controlling your portfolio. Just wanted to point that out.
That's great. This is actually a copy of this from the real estate presentation, so I won't claim credit for this. But it does, again, speak to the intentionality of the way we built the program. We've always, since day one, been trying to put the plan in.
Thanks. Thank you. Thank you. I'll just be really quick up here. My name is Greg Norquist of Russell Investments. Russell has been managing an overlay program for OPERF since 2005. Greg is here to provide an overview of the program.
Short presentation. And really just want to give take the 15 or 20 minutes to just give a chance for question and answer throughout, because have them, but really want to just go through the overview of what the overlay does from a process and function to give that picture for you, discuss performance, and like I said, any questions, fire away as I go through this. So start on page 5. We're certainly different than any other investment manager that you have in the portfolio, who typically have an allocation of money and they go and run their models and they run their portfolio. We're more of a completion manager who's helping you manage liquidity and manage the gyrations of your portfolio. So what we first do is build a picture of where you are from a total portfolio perspective, download custodian data, and then we compare that against where your strategic policy suggests you want to be. So basically, showing where you are and where you want to be. And the difference between that is an unmanaged risk that we fill in the gaps for. So we have guidelines for our portfolio, just like any other manager, that specifies how we fill those gaps in. So at a high level, that's how we operate on a day-to-day basis. flip to page 6, look at the March 31st asset summary, which is kind of a detailed point in time where you ended the quarter. And describe the left-hand column shows your allocation we built up by asset class, your physical portfolio, about $67 billion allocated across equity, fixed income, and the alternatives portfolios. On the far right, you have that strategic policy allocation that we're targeting to match. Because of some of the, we'll call uninvestables, the private markets, the alternative portfolios that aren't readily replicable with the futures overlay, we're really going to allocate the uninvestables to those public markets that have income where we can control your exposures, and that creates the second to right column, which is the overlay target. So then, as I described previously, the physical portfolio is bumped up against that target we solved for what we want to be. And the notable discrepancy you have here versus your policy, if you look at the upper right-hand column, is cash. The cash flows make your portfolio tick on a day-to-day basis. The benefit payments that come out every month and the private market commitments and disbursements that come out are significant for your portfolio. So holding about 2% cash is very typical, and yet that's a drag on your portfolio, right? Yields on cash are zero, you're targeting something around 7% return. That's a big hole to fill. And really, that's the primary hole to fill in the data. So if you look at page 7, that is your cash account and the amount of liquidity that runs through the portfolio over the past 12 months from April 1st last year when we were here.
I'm sorry, Tony, our cash position hasn't been changing historically.
Not on a strategic basis.
No.
Yes. So strategically, the allocation is zero.
Okay.
Right. And so the disconnect you have here is that you need quite a bit of liquidity to manage those monthly $250 million benefit payments, capital calls of $50 to $100 to $200 million on a given day.
Right, because have our, and you may not know this because you haven't been part of this overlay process, has our cash position been growing?
No, not. There's not a deliberate intent to raise the allocation to cash.
Chad, when it draws down to the low point, that's when either Michael Viteri or fixed income will step in and think about raising cash for the next 3 months.
Okay. Yeah. So that's down on a very short term.
And historically, we've been from the overlay for about 11 years now, and in that ballpark, it's never been run real thin, it's never been run much above this.
I'm pretty wondering as we get to sort of the demographic thrust of the baby boomers here, whether we're going to start to see that cash actually increase.
I would guess that the actuaries will certainly know more than what I will just anecdotally observe is that the benefit payments have gone up over the last 5 or so years. So that's certainly part of that. And then you also look at the previous discussion with Ben's portfolio going from 4 to 12%. That needs to be funded with asset source from public markets. So it's all going to flow through over time. And so there's certainly a strong ongoing need.
Pension payments run about $240 a month. So when we're raising cash, we'll generally raise about $1 billion. There'll be $750 million of that is pension run. That's not including any capital calls from real estate, private equity, alternative opportunities. We have to be mindful of what's coming down the pike and raise enough cash in the system.
Yeah.
Mr. Trevor, that should be an asset allocation issue. And when you do your next asset allocation, you'll be looking at all the cash flows, including capital calls and distributions. And over time, as the plan matures, it will require a lot more attention to cash flow management. And that's true particularly as the plan matures, you don't want to meet a near-term liability with a long-term asset. And that would be a key part of the decision-making process.
So who on the staff is the cash cop? Is it you?
No, it's not. It's really a group effort, really. Mike Viteri, Carl Chang, Mike Viteri, and Perrin all collaborate regularly.
So the liquid asset holders.
Yeah.
And we have a troop of folks up on the third floor that that connect very closely with these guys to forecast cash flow and to make sure that we've got the pacing of that as well as we can.
So the one unknown is the capital calls from the private asset portfolio?
Well, the capital calls are better known than the distributions.
Oh. Okay.
We cut our teeth back in 2008, so we were constantly raising cash. We're aware of the dynamic.
Team cash.
Kind of fine-tuned it back then.
But the point is taken, there's a lot of sources and needs of cash, and not all of them are perfectly predictable. really justifies the cash to the city that are meeting those needs. So page 8, just real quickly, what is the market environment that that you're operating in? We look at both global equities and the oil. A year of didn't make it very far in net distance, but was up a little, was down sharply in a couple of sell-offs, and then rebounded over February, March back to close to the flat line. So there wasn't a large risk premium, but obviously ongoing, that's what you're trying to pick up. Bonds, of course, were pretty quiet, and we do know there's an orange line here. Last year and up until December, when the asset allocation study was approved, there was a short duration and an intermediate or an aggregate duration portfolio. So we had both sleeves that we were looking at. And you see there's a note there at March 1st, the implementation of that policy shift. We moved just to a single fixed income basket. So there's aggregate fixed income. So real quick, just from a highlights perspective, and then we'll wrap up pretty quick there. What are we really trying to achieve here with the overlay, and what we're trying to help you achieve is the top line, minimizing the cost of maintaining that liquidity, right? I mentioned earlier, cash is yielding zero. You've got long-term targets, trying to achieve 7% returns, capturing that market risk premium. We do it in such a way that with these daily cash flows and gyrations in the market, they're always buying or selling as we need to into the correct asset class. So if you're overweight an asset class, we're not going to buy more of it. We're going to buy the underweight. And if we have to sell, we're going to sell the overweight. And so we're just always moving you back towards your policy. And the volume of cash flow that goes through this account, by just overlaying that smartly, the right asset class, eliminates really traditional rebalancing needs. You just have enough flow through that portfolio. And the results in terms of capturing risk premium, as I noted above, there wasn't necessarily a strong market risk premium, but we were able to capture $48 million of positive return last year, which is about 10 basis points to the total portfolio. Certainly meaningful, and in that environment, it was really just capturing volatility. Over 5 years, it's been about $400 million. Inception date is climbing back to the flat line after what you might have guessed was a tough time during the financial crisis, where we were plugging bigger holes and managing more risks. And then the second function, as I mentioned, is really managing unintended risk, that asset allocation drift, the ability to do rebalancing trades as needed, first in the overlay, and eventually you're going to have to raise cash from physical portfolios. So that reduces unwanted risks in the portfolio. And then thirdly, the ability to raise cash on a more strategic basis, and Mike Viteri indicated that rather than meeting these small cash flows with hitting the liquid market portfolios, it's more of a strategic view of managing the cash at larger $250, $500 million chunks. So they don't have to worry about where that next cash flow is coming, and nickel and dime managers, they're taking less frequent, larger chunks of money to help manage that cash more effectively. That also saves costs in terms of implementation each year. Be mindful with time here. Just want to highlight on page 10, upper left-hand corner, and we note that this is really filling in the gaps of the portfolio. So you hold this cash that you don't want, which means you're underweight risk assets. We look at the impact of kind of both of those. If you look at the blue line on page 10, your physical portfolio held underweight in asset classes that you wanted, that caused a drag, the overlay filled in that gap. That's really just the description of what it's doing. It's trying to get you back to policy. Last year, that was a positive. I'm going to expect that to be a positive, and that market risk premium is not positive every year. And then on the far right, we benchmark ourselves to what is a variable benchmark, because we don't know if we're going to be equity one day and fixed income maybe the next month. But we measure ourselves for what's called perfect implementation, as if we would buy those asset classes with no cost, as if it was the S&P or global equity benchmark, but it's a blend of the two. And you see that we match that, slightly outperformed it. Our goal is just to match it. We're not trying to add value through our trading. We're trying to just react and fill in the gaps. And with that, let's just finish on page 13, just kind of give a visual of what that cash and underweight asset classes look like before we're involved. And then with the overlay at the bottom half of that chart. So you see the net cash, 2-3% of the portfolio over time. The asset classes are going to move with both cash flow and market movements to over and underweight, primarily underweight because of the cash holdings. And then we look at the net exposure, creating the desired asset class exposure to global equities and fixed income. Your net exposure on that bottom chart is very close to policy with limited deviation, and that's really the goal of the program. So with that, I will pause. Is there any further questions?
Just an observation, not a recommendation by any means, but I know that investment advisors for individuals don't automatically view cash to have a zero strategic value. There are times that investment advisors have recommended some allocation to cash. It's a hard thing to swallow, obviously.
Yeah, I don't necessarily disagree with that, but just in terms of the policy and the strategic allocation that has zero cash, right. We certainly have clients who do have targets the cash, and sometimes more than they have. So it's certainly a possibility.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we're now at the break. So why don't we reconvene at 10:30? Okay. Policy, I think.
Good morning. Tab 5, for those of you who have the presentation deck, we're on page 264, I believe, of the direct assessment. We've had the policy updates. A little background, staff started coming to you with these policy updates back in September of last year. In April of last year, Kim Alton, who's sitting off to your far left, waving her hand. Introduced PolicyStat, which is a new software system which allows us to process and codify all these policies. She's really kind of a program manager that makes sure we address all these policy revisions in a timely manner. Today we're addressing the segregation of policy and procedure to what you have in front of you for public equities on the school fund. I'll be answering questions maybe on public equity, call on school fund, Garrett, and Oregon Church. So the idea before, the reason we started going down this route is that back in 2012, Cortex Applied Research came back to us with a recommendation that our policies and procedures were pretty much a mishmash of OIC policy and best procedures. So the idea is to segregate them, and the outcome of it is what's in front of you. So if you have any questions on any particular policy procedure, we'd be more than happy to take any questions.
I had a question, Mike. On yours, I think the, I don't know how to identify it. Public equity series, let's go to section 5, it's the equity investment manager monitoring.
Oh, yes.
I think it's the eliminating the OIC recommendation to visit with the managers. I think there's a conversation to be had about what we do and how we interact with managers, but it seems to stand out as odd given the other changes. But wanted to hear a little bit of your thinking about that particular.
Sure, sure. So the mandate here for us is really to kind of make our policies and procedures a little cleaner, a little crisper. And in looking at this particular language, the language predates me, goes back 10, 12 years. During the 8 years I've been here, I've never known any OIC member to have an interest in seeing public equity managers. Maybe they did, but it wasn't articulated, never mind finding meeting. So, and given that we've got exciting private equity folks and rock solid real estate, I mean, every other member of the band is here, which is kind of, I don't know,
You guys are really sharp, but let me respond to that because that was my editorial pen, and I was reacting to the word encouraged because I thought that was qualifying in some way that just I was uncomfortable with, and so it was not intended to in any way preclude the OIC members' ability to meet with managers or visit managers. I just wanted it to be in an unqualified way, and so I was playing around with language, and then I thought, well, why do we even need this in here? Because I think it just goes without saying that the discharge of fiduciary responsibility among members could certainly and should certainly include manager meetings when and if possible. But to the extent that that connotates a desire to limit interaction with OIC members, then I would just then prefer to retain it and then amend the staff motion to say, please approve all these policy changes, but for that one where we will retain the one sentence about OIC manager meetings.
Thank you. What it made me do was reflect on what we do, what our role is, how we interact with managers, depending on who, what the expertise level is on the board, that might be a public equity person in the future. I generally don't like that. But I'm open to a conversation about what we do in the future, so if you guys decide that you want to have that conversation, I would both be jump into it. So I prefer the amendment, but we're interested in hearing what the other
people. You prefer to leave it in?
I would prefer to leave this.
Yes, and then respect, and not eliminate it without having a larger conversation about the role we play in managing oversight, not just for public equity, but for all. Okay. Might make sense then. I'm not too sure if the other asset class policies and procedures have the same language that they do with some of the So it might make sense to move it up into a higher level policy.
Well, just
the wording of it.
That's exactly the conversation I think we probably should have, and then I think on a more fundamental basis, like really, should we be? Right? I think that question is out there.
The governance question.
Right.
Sure.
Right, and it's an important one as we evolve. But I don't want to have a little conversation. I'm open. You laughing?
No, I'm
laughing. Any other board members have thoughts about that?
Having a discussion is probably a good one. And I don't think it hurts to have the dialogue.
And let me just interject that Mike makes a good point in that it's embedded deep in the policy hierarchy, and that I think is just an artifact of this being years and maybe decades stale. So to the extent that we collectively agree, at least in the interim, it should be retained. It should at least be elevated to a higher level in the hierarchy, because it's strange to have it in public equity and not referenced anywhere else.
Oh, it's not referenced anywhere else.
No, that's why it jumped out at me. It's very peculiar that it's, you know, three levels or four levels deep in the hierarchy, and it's unique to public equity.
So it's not in any other.
I haven't seen it. Now, it may emerge as we go through this process that we're going through. It's going to be probably at least another two council meetings that we subject you to dozens of these policy revisions, where the revisions are 99% just the transition into the policy stat application. There are very few material changes. This was one because it jumped out at me as such an anomaly.
Do you have any insight on this?
Well, two points. One, whichever motion you have, you're going to want to clarify what you've done, whether you're just adopting the recommendation or you're tinkering with it. But fundamental to the overall question is, what is the governance obligation of the board? These policies that you establish are always subject to your own revision at any time. But to the degree that you want to have your policies commensurate with what your overall fiduciary obligations are, I think that's a good thing. I think this discussion about where to embed your due diligence, your governance, is a good conversation to have. I would suggest that you do so. One thought to have is, what, not necessarily make it that's recommended or something of that sort, but just say you have the ability to do so. So if the case by case comes up, you can choose to or not choose to, but you don't have a value judgment ahead of time as to whether or not you need to in a particular instance. But all of that can be addressed in a larger conversation where you have something that looks at what you're going to be doing as a board or individual members of that council across your various portfolio allocations.
I might suggest that staff takes back then as a project to remove it here and look for a better place to embed it.
One problem that I have with it as it stands is that it's silent about whether OIC members do those visits in concert with the staff or individually, and I favor the project, don't favor the latter.
Again, that's insight into, or reinforces the challenge I had in thinking about it. You know, I reacted to the word encouraged, and I thought, what's a better qualifying word? And then I said, why do I want a qualifying word at all? And so, again, this is just reinforcing the reaction I had. And so, I would suggest that we eliminate it from here, but look at a higher level in the hierarchy to reestablish it and then work on the language that is maybe more universal.
I favor that as well.
And let me just second the two thoughts that have been expressed here. I don't know why you would want to precondition or pre-qualify the capacity or the ability of a council member to act in an appropriate governance role as the circumstances warrant.
Okay, so can we consider the public equity security effects 0.5? Are you guys okay with that?
Sure. Just remove in the IMB 607 from approval at this point in time.
If that's the motion you want to make, that's great.
Okay. I will make that for everyone's questions or answers. Jump in.
May I just ask one quick question? Maybe this is a legal question. I never get asked legal questions. This is exciting. So the board members have individual fiduciary liability for the management decisions that are made with regard to the portfolio. Doesn't that pretty much mean that we have an obligation to use whatever means necessary to uphold our fiduciary obligations, including if we need to, meeting with the individual managers?
Well, I would rephrase your statements a little bit. I think you have individual fiduciary obligations. I don't know if any of you have a current liability. I wouldn't want to suggest that. As part of those obligations, you can act through agents. In your due diligence, you can act directly. And I think that you reserve the capacity to determine whether acting directly or acting through agents makes sense, or a combination of the two.
Regardless of the policy.
Correct. But I think your policy should admit to either option if that's what you want to leave yourself with, that flexibility.
I'm going to vote against the motion. This isn't the last time we should take up this issue. Obviously, it's a bigger issue, but I think that sentence, as it stands, it just doesn't belong there. Your motion was
I haven't made it yet, but the motion would be leave it there until we can talk about the big discussion, and then you like it as it is.
Well, the treasurer's comment it gets in my head, because when I reacted to the word encouraged from the perspective of, well, we encourage it, so what does that mean if somebody never visits a manager? I didn't want the converse to to be viewed as a deficiency.
I think that's a good point. How do you put it
down? So that your issue,
Jeff? Yeah.
Your...
Yeah, I just, it's not, this isn't the way our policy should be in the long term. And so,
so you object to leaving it as is with the clear expectation that we do address it?
Right.
You object to even that solution?
I'd like to eliminate it and still view it in the larger context.
Oh, I see. Okay. So leave the proposal as it is.
Yeah.
Tied yourself?
Yeah.
Very impressive. Very impressive.
I would like to actually point to the Alabama Council Fund. Because like John Sherman alluded to and Mike Viteri, a lot of the changes have been, separating the policies with the strategic component of the main details. It has pretty much stayed the same. For the Common School Fund, particular to Investment 904, which is the fixed income component, we have dialed down the return expectations to 35 basis points. So that may be a change, and I just want to kind of point that out. And together with that, we've changed. The reason for that is sort of twofold. First, kind of lowering the requirement. And then we also did change the fixed income benchmark to the Barclays U.S. Aggregate Bond Index, essentially removing the below investment grade component. So while active managers can take, for managers can take on that active risk, they're not forced to, and therefore, we believe that the return expectations should be lower.
One other comment I'd like to make in one of the documents, there was a change in benchmarks for a couple of mandates we had. Global IT West, Michael Cat Value, Global IT West, Michael Cat Value, policy space of the UIC for any benchmark changes. And typically, what happens in this space is we find a manager who places a developed market manager, and we want to expand that to emerging markets. You're changing the mandate, and therefore, we need to change the benchmark. In this case, what happened is that the service provider, the index provider, was Russell. They created these global XUS, Microcap Growth and Value indices for us. At the time, we launched these strategies. 6 months later, they were acquired by London Stock Exchange. London Stock Exchange has been integrating the FTSE, Financial Times Stock Exchange Index Group, and Russell, and they've gone through and rationalized by these indices. So the growth and the value microcap, global XUS microcap strategies are gone. What we have left is the core. So both the mandates we have now have a new benchmark, which is the global XUS core. Not very exciting, but I did want to make reference to it because it is a benchmark change, but not anything that the mandate is not changing, just the benchmark. So it's in there.
Okay. Any other questions?
I'm here. I move that we accept the policy updates as proposed.
We have okay. So, do we have to vote on this, or do we?
They haven't had a second yet.
If there is a second,
you can have a discussion on the motion before you vote after the second.
Okay. After the second?
Yes.
Okay. Is there a second?
All second.
I guess I would probably tend to agree with Rakaia, is I would hate to take something out until we have a better plan for what that connotation is, how we're going to perform within that, you know, encourage the business managers. So, again, I think it's just I don't like taking anything out until I replace it with something I feel more comfortable with.
table all of this except for that one?
Well, if there's a larger discussion, is that the only one we can send it out?
Yep.
Hold on, no.
Okay. Do we have an amended?
Well, someone would either need to rescind their motion or their second, or vote on the current motion that it sits on the table.
Okay, so is anyone rescinding their motion?
No, I think the sentence is toxic the way it is. In the spirit of collaboration, I will rescind my second.
Okay.
And that will force our hand.
Right, okay. So do I have an amended motion to maybe pull that one out and vote on the rest of them? Second?
Second.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye. Opposed?
Okay. Great.
Thank you. It's much more exciting than I thought it
was.
So next on the agenda is I will be reviewing the Common Schooling School Fund and the review and together with Tim Holloway, who will be spending the last portion of the 20 minutes that we have talking about how the Common School Fund has benefited the school.
Could you do me a favor?
Sure.
Could you move the mouse as a laser thing to get right on the
So the first part of the second, which I wanted to discuss, is like I said, I want to go through the performance. I don't want to spend too much time there, and I want to make sure that Jim has enough time for the information and insight and perspective that he has. I also want to, I know we see a lot of new members on the board, and really as a little pressure for those that are still here, provide a little color on the fund restructuring of the Common School Fund, sort of around the era of, or year of 2007-08, kind of post-global financial crisis. We made a lot of changes that are still in place today, and all very additive. So I just kind of wanted to highlight those. Specifically because we might be, you know, maybe now is a good time to take a look at it again and see if we can make further enhancements. And then finally, I want to just touch upon two initiatives that we have moving forward for the year that we'd like to tackle together with the Department of State. Before I start at all, again, new faces, I don't often come in front of you, so I just want to introduce myself. My name is Paula Nealon. I am an investment officer with the public equity markets. I've been with Treasury for about 2 years. Most recently, I took on the Common School portfolio from Mike Bueller, who has now moved on to a different role within Treasury. So this is my first time here giving the review, and if everything goes well, you'll talk to me again next year. So performance. All right, can't do this now. Performance. We know that the 2015 was a really challenging market. Didn't really matter where you hid, diversification was not something that helped in anyone's portfolio. We had emerging markets that was down 15%, commodities another 25%. Really the only asset class providing us with any kind of positive returns, and very modest ones, was within the U.S. large public companies, as well as high yield domestic fixed income. So it was a difficult, challenging year. On the developed international side, we did see positive returns in local currencies, but when you translated it to the dollar as a U.S. investor, we also got hurt there. So all in all, kind of a bad year. In addition to that, we saw declining oil prices, the China slowdown, Fed rate hike for the first time in 9 years. I mean, I keep going, but there was very little good news. Despite these challenges on a 1 year, the fund was ahead of its policy index by 1.4%, actually delivering a positive number, 0.46%, versus the policy benchmark of negative almost 1%. More importantly, over the last 5 years, the fund has returned an annualized 7.4%. And ahead of the benchmark by about 55 basis points. So, pretty good. I can't take the credit for any of this. I just got this portfolio, so, but thanks to Mike's good work and really a lot of the health comic book treasury staff in general, the fundable positions. If there are no questions on the performance, I want to move on to kind of the evolution of the Common School Fund portfolio. So if we take a step back, back in 2007, OIC approved a 10% allocation to private equity. And that has been a huge tailwind to the portfolio. If you look at the five-year numbers across the different asset classes within the portfolio, certainly the returns is the strongest in that area, followed by domestic equities. In 2008, there was a further enhancement to the fund. Back then, we had one quant manager essentially exposing us to both domestic and international markets. So it was really a single manager fund. It wasn't very well diversified. And after the 2007 quant meltdown, it was sort of, when everyone realized, well, quant managers are not all unique and they may be pursuing all the similar factors, staff sort of went to build out the manager lineup, adding fundamental managers to complement the quant manager, the one quant manager. We also expanded active management on the international side, as well as domestic. We moved to more of a global benchmark to reduce the home country bias that we had, and we included an allocation to emerging markets. So really having a lot more of a solid portfolio. So with that said, the greatest changes have taken place back in 2008. And if you look back, similar to what we experienced in Oprah on the public equity side, most of the active returns has come from the international sleeve of the portfolio versus the domestic. Now, moving forward, what we'd like to do is an asset allocation was done in 2013 by FIS, our previous consultant, and that was more of an informal study. No real changes came of that in terms of the asset allocation per se. Where you saw sort of changes on the margin were maybe some manager upgrades here and there. But really at the time, the question was, okay, how can we build a portfolio that'll preserve the spending power of the funds, the corpus, as well as be able to pay out the 4% distribution policy as dictated by the Department of State Land. And the result was, as mentioned, some manager upgrades, no changes in the asset allocation policy. I think now is kind of a great opportunity, and one of the initiatives that we have moving forward this year is leveraging our consultants' talent to take a look once again at the structure of composition. Right now we have a 70-30 mix, 10% in private equity, and then 30% fixed income, and then the remaining 30% is public equities, which is pretty much 50-50 split between domestic and international. But I think it's a good opportunity now to ask ourselves, are there any other additional asset classes that we can incorporate to enhance returns? Whether it be something like a core real estate fund to provide income, whether it be increase our allocation maybe marginally within private equity or liquid alternatives, perhaps even reduce fixed income and further bolster our returns. These are sort of all questions that we don't have answers for. The study hasn't been done yet, but all these things that we're kind of contemplating together and hope to have something more concrete in the near future. So that's initiative number one. Initiative number two has been really speaking to Jim here and him sharing a lot of his concerns. I've learned a lot over the last month and a half about, revenue sources of the Common School Fund and distribution needs, whether it's determined by the policy or sometimes being asked by legislators to provide additional distribution amounts. These are a lot of challenges because what you're trying to do is you're trying to grow the fund. You're trying to provide, necessary funding for schools, but also it's a delicate balance between the current needs of the schools as well as future needs. So We plan to revisit the distribution policy. Right now, the last one that was adopted was in 2009. And at that time, it was section 4%. And essentially, the way it's calculated, it takes the average balance of the last 3 years of the common school fund market value and pays out 4%. Now, if there's been a significant change defined by over 11% year over year, or from the preceding 3 years to the next, payout becomes equal to 5%. And what we really need to ask ourselves, and I know that the Department of State Land has done a lot of internal work trying to answer that, and where we would like to get a lot more educated on maybe looking at other, how other states are doing it, what we want to be able to answer, what is a sustainable distribution amount? Right now, we're set at 4%. Is that sustainable? Yeah. Is it 5? Is it more like 3? We don't know the answer, but we're hoping to get a little bit more clarity on that with again, the hunger challenge. And unless anyone has any particular questions, what I thought might be more helpful is to turn it to Jim so that he can kind of give his perspective, and I think you'll get more of a holistic view of kind of how these two things come together, and then you can, we'll set some time to ask questions. If that's okay? Yeah?
Great. Thank you, Paula. Good morning, Chair Durant, members of the council. I'm Jim Paul, the director of the Department of State Lands. I, too, am new to my position, just of a couple months, so definitely all new faces here for me, except for one. Good morning, Chair Durant. I'd like to first just spend a few minutes talking about history and purpose of the Common School Fund, just to give you some background on sort of the story of the origins of the fund and how we got to where we are today. Talk a little bit about Department of State Land's perspective on what constitutes the Common School Fund investment portfolio holistically, and then end with just touching on a few key issues and recent developments relevant to the fund. So the Common School Fund's origin goes back to statehood and Oregon's Admissions Act and the original Constitution were part of the promise and the commitment for Oregon being accepted into the Union was receiving 3.4 million acres of common school lands that were to be managed, are to be managed principally for public schools. Common schools is the former term for K-12 schools, so we use the two interchangeably. Congress set aside those schools for a number of Western states as they were brought into the Union because as a nation we were cash poor and land rich. And the intent originally of those lands, if you look at the Constitution and Admissions Act, was really to dispose of those lands and generate cash, generate capital to go towards funding schools. So Oregon did that in a major way for the first 50 years or so of statehood. And sold about 80% of those lands. Tide shifted a little in terms of the sentiment towards selling versus holding around early 1900s, and since then the land base has been fairly stable at about 750,000 acres of trust lands, and we currently manage those lands. The majority of those are range lands in eastern Oregon, about 600,000 acres, and the rest are dispersed between forest lands, industrial, commercial, residential, ag lands, and what we call stewardship land. The primary purpose, as I said, is for the benefit of public schools, but a key principle that we have to apply is the intergenerational equity principle. We cannot favor either current generations over future, nor future generations over current, and are charged with managing the lands in that way under the guidance and governing authority of the State Land Board. And the State Land Board is made up of the Governor, Secretary of State, and the Treasurer for their office, the duties, and that's established in the Constitution. So right now, the fund, I know Paula mentioned this, as of the end of December, is worth $1.42 billion. And I said I'd talk about how ESL envisions or looks at the portfolio itself. We actually look at both the fund, the formal fund that all of you oversee, as well as the real property assets combined. That's what we look at as the entire company. non-school fund portfolio.
The real property assets that we manage, we estimate are worth close to $700 million. Our best estimate now is about $680 million. If you combine that with the formal investment fund, you're looking at about a 70%, 30% ratio, 30% overall, the overall value is in our land holdings. Because of the nature of these lands, they were granted to us, so we weren't able to select them. They were every 16th and 36th section. We are managing what we have to work with, and a lot of these lands are not very productive, and that's reflected in our returns on those lands. Return on asset value of those lands is well below 1%. In recent years, we're at about 0.1% return on asset value. We netted about $640,000 off those lands in the most recent fiscal year, 15. A big reason why those returns are especially low right now, which I'll talk about in a little bit, the issues is what's occurring on our forest lands with constraints related to the Endangered Species Act. And actually that's indicative of a really groundswelling shift in terms of the revenues that we generate that we add to the fund. There's been a shift in the last decade from our property management providing the large majority of the revenue, new revenues coming into the fund from DSL's management. Up until about 10, 15 years ago, we would generate anywhere from $8 to $12 million a year, sometimes as high as $15 million a year, primarily off of our timber management practices on the Elliott State Forest, to now we are at a deficit on the Elliott State Forest. We're losing about $500,000 to $1 million a year. And we're in the process of dealing with that, but while we're dealing with that, we are counting losses. And instead, what's happened in the last decade is now the unclaimed property contributions into the fund have grown exponentially from $200,000 to maybe a few million a year to now the $20 to $30 million a year net into the fund as unclaimed property in order to which the department manages.
Explain that. Unclaimed. Property?
Unclaimed property. So this is property. This isn't sort of lost and found type of item. This is unclaimed financial property. So an example is people put a deposit on for a rental unit and they leave the state or move to another rental unit and they forget about their deposit. They forget that they have it for bank accounts. People don't necessarily allocate where their money in their bank accounts are going to go. When they pass away, they go unclaimed for a period of time. Usually, the heirs will figure it out and find that they do rightfully own the property and will come and claim the property from DSL. We, right now, are about 50% of the unclaimed property that gets brought to DSL that we put into the fund actually gets claimed. The rest sits in the fund, and the proceeds of those monies go towards growing the corpus.
But I just want to be clear, that does not belong to the fund ever, right? Of all they're doing is accruing the interest on the unclaimed property. That's not true.
That's correct. Yes, thank you, Paula. The unclaimed property, we have to hold in perpetuity for the rightful owners of that property. It never sheets to the state as a state ownership. And right now, the portion of that $1.42 billion that constitutes those types of dollars is over half a billion dollars. Like $510 or about $920 million, I think, was the latest number.
Yeah, so the corpus itself is really valued at $900 million. And then we talked about a market value of portfolio being almost worth $2 billion.
So Paul mentioned the distribution fund. I want to talk about that a little bit next. The distribution right now, policy is 4% of the average. So, for example, in fiscal year 2014 and 2015, the total distributions were $105 million, which is about 1% of the education budget. And while percentage-wise this is very small, since 2009, the most recent update and revision to the policy, since the Land Board adopted the 2009 policy, every biennium since then, the legislature in one form or another has made a request of the Land Board to disperse an extra 1% in order to make the school budgets whole, which is on the order of $10 to $14 million.
So while a very small portion of the budget, every little bit counts, and the land board has had to address that request from the legislature now for the fourth biennium in a row. And in each case, they have distributed an additional 1% to go towards the school budget. I won't go into any more details on the specifics of the policy. Paula covered that fairly well. However, I will say that at the most recent land board meeting, which was just last week, the department received support from the land board to move forward with looking at taking a relook at the current distribution policy and working with the Treasury and the Investment Division to take a closer look at our policy and potentially bring it back to a future land board for an update or revision. The timing is actually pretty ripe for that. In recent history, we have updated the policy every 5 years, so it's been 7 years since the last update. So we think the timing's right. So we welcome that support and direction from the land board, and we'll be starting down that work here in the coming months. Let me talk a little bit about just quickly the situation with the Elliott State Forest. Due to the presence of a couple of endangered species on the property, the northern spotted owl and a seabird called the marble burlesque, since the early 2000s, there's been a steady decline in the revenues we were seeing off those lands. We've worked for years with the federal government to try and adopt what's called a habitat conservation plan that we were trying would provide assurances around a higher level of revenue, but also assurances around protection of species. We were unable to achieve that after more than a decade of negotiations and work. So the land board adopted a new forest management plan that we believe struck the right balance and was going to achieve the same ends. The department was sued over that plan within a matter of a couple of months. Long story short, we did have that lawsuit dismissed. As a result, we had unilaterally chose to change our protection policies on the forest that has now made it virtually impossible for us to generate a net revenue. We are generating some revenue, but the cost of managing the forest just to raise the costs are higher than the revenues we can generate. So we're in the middle of a process, we're 18 months into a process that we're projecting will hopefully culminate at the end of 2017 with a transfer of ownership of the Elliott State Forest to another owner. A transfer that would occur with the Common School Fund receiving fair market value for the property, and then those monies going towards a better purpose, we believe, for in terms of the purpose of the fund. The board's directed us if that sale proceeds, those funds would go directly into the Common School Fund. The second issue I wanted to touch on was what in the department called a real estate asset management plan. This is our long-term strategic plan for how we manage our real property assets. It was overhauled pretty significantly in 2006, and it directed the department to try and basically reallocate its real property holdings to work towards divesting the properties that were poor performing or underperforming and reinvesting proceeds from those properties into higher performing assets. We have simply not been able to do that work on a scale that's made much of a dent at all. So we sold probably 7,000 or 8,000 acres worth of properties. We've generated a total of between $15 to $20 million in value of those properties. But given the overall holdings and the overall performance, that really haven't been able to make a dent in the low performance of the land. So we are actually looking at revisiting that strategic plan potentially in the next year to see if we want to continue trying this course or look at something different depending on the land board's direction. And finally, I was going to touch just briefly on the Portland Harbor Superfund site, which also has a tie with the school fund. Very quickly, the Department of State Lands manages a number of other programs whose monies we generate from those programs, the state ownership of waterways, removal fill, and wetland permitting. Any net revenues from those programs go into the Common School Fund. We generally, barely, are right at the line in terms of generating revenue to pay for those programs. However, we have a current potential liability with the state-owned waterways in Portland Harbor and are working very closely with the Department of Justice to manage that So there's potential liability to the state of Oregon overall based on depending on what happens with the disposition of the super on site and liabilities and the next box. We continue to work through that, and we continue to raise the DOJ the point that this potential liability is, we believe, one of the state overall and not one that should rest with the Commons Pool Fund. We're a couple of years away, I believe, a year or two away at least from a record decision, so nothing new is going to transpire anytime soon, but that's an issue that's sitting out there as well. With that, I will stop and be happy to answer any questions.
So you're not asking for anything today, but you're thinking you might come back between now and next year's meeting with proposed investment policy change, or?
Not so much changes to the investment policy, but certainly if we conduct and finalize an asset allocation, and kind of one of the, in terms of the timing, not only has it been a while since the formal asset allocation was done, and the Commons Pool Fund policy actually, another one thing where we put in, every 3 years we should kind of look to do a formal study, so we're kind of around, we're a little past that time. And in addition, with the sale of the Elliott Funds, which could signify a pretty large dollar amount in the range of $300 to $400 million, that would be a good opportunity, given that the fund would increase in size, we would have monies to allocate to potentially different asset classes that we currently don't have. So to answer your question, you may see us here before the end of the year. Yeah, that's the plan.
Okay, sure. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Great. Thank you.
You both did an awesome job
on
your first time.
That's because nobody
protests. Yeah. Okay, John, I think you're up.
All right, agenda item number 7, asset allocation and net asset value update. All the accounts under OST management are in line with their strategic allocation targets. The exception, of course, is OPERF with the additional work that Ben needs to do, and we talked about that earlier today. And then you have the NAV charts after that. And then agenda item number 8, the calendar, preview of coming attractions. You've got the rest of the year laid out for you, at least in preliminary form. We have been wrestling around about August 3rd, and it looks like the alternatives are just not viable, so we're going to go back to August 3rd, even though we'll probably have a very narrow quorum. And then I guess the other thing I'd like to say is just apologize for the difficulty we've been having with director's desk. We really don't understand it, but we do have a lot of people working on it, so there's my great hope that we'll have that resolved before the next meeting, but it also gives me an opportunity to introduce publicly May Fanning and Elise Jacobson, who are supporting me and all the work that we do in preparation for these meetings. So we've got the A-team on it, and we'll figure it out. Oh, and we've got also, in her first OIC meeting, we've got Amanda Kingsbury, who's joined John Hershey and his team in the alternatives world. So new faces and new muscle in the investment division, which is great news.
Amanda, can you stand up?
Yeah,
you can probably see me.
It's great to have you.
Hi, I'm Rob Siskin. I'm president of SEIU 503 OPEU, and thank you for allowing me to comment. We represent over 55,000 workers throughout Oregon in a variety of sectors. take a couple days to go along with our equity inclusion partners. We just sent the OIC members a letter stressing that it is a priority, ourselves and our coalition partners, that equity and inclusion opportunities for people of color and women be created in the financial investment sectors, so that these essential groups who have been on the fringe of our economy, as data will show, in how it is developed and sustained, will become the vital part of the economy that they should be. The letter is based on a letter released nationally by SEIU President Mary King Henry. And before I start, here are the coalition partners that are advocating for equity inclusion opportunities as we are. Myself, Rob Siss, President of SEIU Local 503, Andrea Miller, Executive Director of CALSA, Jen Baker, Political Director of the Oregon Nurses Association, Reverend Joseph Santos Lyons, Executive Director of OPANO, KP Jama, Executive Director of the Center for Intercultural Organizing, Lakinye Harmon Johnson, President of the Urban League of Oregon, of Portland, excuse me, and Trent Lutz, Political Director of the Oregon Education Association. We also attached some supplemental information to the letter showing the economic benefits of equity and inclusion practices. So here's the letter. I just want to read it for the record. Dear members of the Oregon Investment Council, as an equity inclusion coalition advocating for the sensitivity, recognition, and involvement of diversity in all facets of society, government, and business, we strongly urge the Oregon Investment Council to make equity and inclusion part of its investment beliefs. We believe the value of equity inclusion is justified consideration in investment decisions made by the OIC on behalf of PERS members, not just because people of color and women especially lag behind inclusion in the investment sector, but because of research showing how investment returns may be maximized by ensuring diversity on boards and among financial professionals. When people of color and women are underrepresented on corporate boards and in the investment industry, this dramatically limits the industry's understanding of some of the most important trends and potentials of our economy and overlooks the very valuable and expanding communities of color, keeping them on the fringe of our economy rather than recognizing them as vibrant participants. Recently, SEIU President Mary King Henry, and SEIU represents over 2 million workers in this country, announced SEIU's initiative to promote equity and inclusion in the financial services industry, lamenting this startling lack of diversity. President Henry cited the need for the type of dynamic change that engages the broad range of talents that we see reflected in our membership. Those responsible for managing SEIU members' investments ought to reflect on the rich diversity of our membership. To bring this transformation, President Henry urged these initiatives: implement something akin to the National Football League's Rooney Rule to encourage diverse hiring. And just to remind you, that was action taken by the NFL's diversity committee to ensure that they created opportunities for inclusion for people of color and women. Request personal diversity data from asset managers, auditors, and consultants. Implement a robust corporate governance program and recruit and train a diverse next generation of trustees. We support these necessary steps as a long overdue solution in addressing a significant shortcoming in the financial industry that has left a large and significant part of our population outside. Ironically, it is also a population that contains a significant number of pension plan members, plans we firmly believe would increase in value as the value of equity and inclusion is honored in practice. Thank you very much. And again, like I said, we have sent this all out to all the OIC members, and we have attached supplemental information that shows the economic benefits of equity inclusion practices. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just a question, if I may.
Sure.
I like the format of both letters, both the national and the state letters, because it didn't just say that these are good things to do, which is undeniable, but it actually makes sense economically.
Right.
But do you have any sense of whether similar letters are directed to our peers in other states?
No, I don't. This letter by our President Mary Kay Henry, like I said, was sent out nationally. I don't think it got the media exposure that probably it warranted. And we took that and wanted to make sure we were doing something within Oregon. As you know, how many of our members are in PERS, but we also, of course, coalesce with a lot of the other unions that have PERS members, et cetera. So we just wanted to make sure we were doing something. And again, we are in this broad coalition of equity and inclusion, and we have acted on a number of things to really honor people of color and women having more participation in the various either business sectors or in various parts of society. So this is what we are doing.
It would be helpful to us if we knew that other states were being pushed to act in the same way.
And I'll tell you what, we will try to find out that information and get back to you. I think that's a very good question. Like I said, we are more concerned about what we're doing here in Oregon, but I will try to find out what kind of, hopefully, a common mission is out there.
Really?
So thanks for asking that.
I actually do believe this is happening in other states. I've had some conversations with folks in California recently. I just want you to be aware that there's sort of a nascent effort as well to create a database of women and qualified minority board trustees and board members.
Right.
And it's a really good effort because your underlying economic data is actually backed. So if you have a board of directors for a publicly held corporation and it is a diverse and inclusive board, they tend to get better results as a result of that inclusion and diversity. And so what you're saying makes a lot of sense. I appreciate you bringing it up.
Yeah, I think I was thinking of one example of a corporate board, for instance, who was all men and he had dealt with cosmetics. You know, that would be industry.
That raises a lot of questions.
You know your customer base. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks.
All right, meeting adjourned.
I'm going to look at the